Hi everyone, I'm Adrienne Adamy.
I'm Sammy Adamy.
And I'm Ollie Patrick.
We're the hosts of the Modern Wellness Podcast. A brand new show where we discuss the latest headlines, trends, facts and fads to decode the world of wellness.
As industry insiders, we'll share our analysis, opinions and unfiltered commentary.
We discuss topics ranging from how to build and launch a business in the wellbeing industry,
the weight loss drug that's been prescribed to millions of people,
the increase of loneliness in young males. How could this impact our health?
And as wellbeing and travel merge, would you even consider booking a hotel that didn't have a gym?
Our opinions are shaped by the work we do as brand advisors and entrepreneurs working across the wellness industry.
Our day-to-day lives include testing new products, delivering wellness workshops and retreats, and designing clinical assessments.
But we live in the real world, so we understand the challenges of managing work, travel, kids, training, and life.
Search Modern Wellness Podcast. Brand new shows every Monday and Wednesday.
I first had that experience. I was days sober, running a pub, and I woke up one morning and the window was open and I could hear birds singing in the trees. And I realised I hadn't heard that for 20 years, 30 years. It was so beautiful to hear just a bird singing, you know, and recovery opens up that part of your life. You narrow down the fear, but you also narrow down the joy, and getting recovery can open up the fear a little bit, but also it opens up the joy.
Hi everybody, welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefield. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction and recovery, and I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. My guest this week is David Smallwood. He shares his insights about anxiety, stress, the importance of addressing early trauma, and how addiction can actually be a valuable gift. David is a published author of a brilliant book called Who Says I'm an Addict? And in the show notes, we'll tell you where to buy it. He's a highly credited therapist and counsellor. David is the former clinical director of the Kushnek practice in Zurich and was the addiction treatment manager at North London Priory for 10 years. With 37 years of recovery, David's main aim is to remove or reduce fear from people's lives. Before we jump in with this week's guest, I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys. David, thank you so much for coming on. This is powerful. It's such a privilege to have you here.
Oh, you're welcome.
So I'm trying not to be a bit intimidating.
Well, take me off.
Okay, fine. Because you are a renowned therapist. And I remember I went into treatment in the Priory in North London, not when you was there,
Yes. Unfortunately,
but always people always say, oh, was you there when David Smallwood was running it? And they say it with kind of like this edgy thing, and I never worked out what it was. But you have 30 years sobriety as well.
37.
Yeah.
37, yeah.
Which is really inspiring. So thank you for being a good example.
I went to my sponsor's 40th birthday party recently, and he was there with a guy who 12-stepped him who was 50 years clean.
Really?
Yeah. Amazing.
Wow. It's inspiring to see, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because, yeah. You know you can do it and you're on the right path. Before we talk about therapy, recovery and addiction, I'd love to know about yourself, David, where you're from and how your upbringing was.
Very poor background. My dad was a drinking alcoholic. My mum was extremely traumatized and nervous. Both her parents were dead by the time she was 12. The family split up. She found herself homeless, found my dad and clung on like a limpet, they were both lovely people, but both had so much going on. My mum was having nervous breakdowns, my dad drinking all the money, my mum going out to work to make the family work. And I'm sort of looking up going, what about me? And consequently felt completely alone and left out and went into myself. I was just scared. My mum taught me to be anxious. And I hated school. I was beaten up every day. I didn't go to a grammar school, went to a secondary modern school. Wasn't even in the A stream because I was, just withdrawn. Mm. And finally, at 15 years old, the headmaster of the school said, the best a boy can do from this school is to go to Alfred Herbert's at Coventry, become a toolmaker. So I thought, well, I'll try it. And I went and got the job. But, I had no clue that I was gay at that moment in time. Absolutely none. And I found myself working with 4,000 homophobic Coventry City supporters.
Wow.
The conversation from Monday to Wednesday was a sort of takedown of the match on the last Saturday. And then from Thursday to Friday, it was what they were going to do to the other team on Saturday. That was it. There's no other conversation. Yeah. I hated every minute of it and tried to get out of it and couldn't. And then eventually got to be, I met a guy who was a sales director of a company and he offered me a job. And then it really got nasty because I was terrified. I was so nervous and so shy and so anxious that I would go out, do the job, and then I'd have to come home and drink. To take down, to relax. And it worked until it didn't work.
How old were you at this point, David?
The time I was working as a salesman, I was 27.
How long did you start a factory for? Because I had, we had work experience at school and I wanted to go to a mechanic shop to work on cars or a motorbike shop. That was it. They stuck me in a double glazing factory in Romford. And the conversation was about exactly what you just said, or fights over who's playing what radio station.
Yeah.
And I had this guy come up to me. I was, 15? Must have been 19 or 20. And he said, excuse me, he said, the last kid that worked here put his initials of his girlfriend on the wall. You're not going to do that, are you? And I just thought, what? What are you talking about? If that's the level of what we're doing.
Yeah.
And then someone said, I heard you box, let's go and have a fight outside.
It works for lots of people, but it didn't work for me. Got to be a salesman, became sales manager, sales director, still drinking. Then eventually I changed jobs, worked for an American company from Minneapolis. And the fear just got worse and worse and worse and worse, and the drinking got worse and worse and worse. And I'd gone to the doctor at 15 years old and said, I can't cope. And the doctor very, very obligingly hooked me on benzodiazepines.
Right.
And I took those from when I was 15 until I was 36. And a combination of that and Jack Daniels was like perfect. Feeling no pain.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you very much. Life's a bit smoother.
At 36, I had a fit from withdrawal from alcohol and drugs, and I was a salesman driving a car, so I couldn't drive.
Was this because you were trying to get off it yourself, Dave?
No, it was just I knew I was working for a company, and I knew that I wasn't, I just wasn't working, and I knew I was going to get the sack, so I decided to quit taking benzos, quit drinking, and quit smoking all at the same time.
Right.
And the net result was 2 days later, after getting the sack, I had a withdrawal fit. And was in hospital for 2 weeks, and then came out and thought, well, I've got to do something. I know, we'll get a pub. So, you know.
Good choice.
I got a pub, and I was in that trade for 10 years. Very successfully, because at the same time I got recovery. You know, I went into the pub like 3 months after getting in the pub. I was carted off to a psychiatric hospital. I woke up one morning with a consultant psychiatrist, a social worker, my brother, and my wife, all looking at me, going, "What's go?" And I'm going, "What's going on?" And I had a blackout, yeah. And threatened my cleaning lady with a very sharp lockback knife that I carried all the time, so I was frightened.
Yeah, that would get you put.
Yes. And he said, either go in voluntarily or I'll section you. So I went in voluntarily. I went in voluntarily with 9 brandies in a glass.
You might as well make an entrance.
So I cried for 3 days and couldn't understand what was happening. Why weren't people, why couldn't I feel loved? Why didn't people take care of me rather than being aggressive towards me? And, you know, it stands me in good stead now knowing what it's like, because I don't want anybody ever to feel like I felt.
Yeah.
So it's really important that people get what they need. And over the years, my view on how to get people well has changed so dramatically. You mentioned the Priory. I was renowned at the Priory for being very incisive, but very in your face. And I don't regret that, but there's a better way of doing it.
In your book, Who Says I'm an Addict, which I would highly recommend, you said in there that when you was in the North London Priory group that you told everyone to call themselves an addict rather than an alcoholic or something else. Why was that?
Well, because addiction comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles or pills. And my experience is that if you have one, you know, I used to make a joke, you come in with one addiction and you get 9 free.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people come in for alcohol. We get them detoxed. They start doing recovery, but they cross addict without even thinking about it.
Now, I had a whole question about that cross addiction, which I'd love to talk about, because when I was in there, Hilary Betts was there, and you'd be slipped a brown envelope to go and do SLA stuff.
Yes.
For those who don't know, it's sex, love, addiction. And I was thinking, up in here for... I've done my 28 days, I'm doing another 28 days, I have no brown envelope. And then the morning came when I got a brown envelope, I was like, shit. And it was what you said, I came in here for one thing and now they're giving me loads of other, not realising that it's just uncovered, which is there. But I took tracksuit training gear because I thought when I'm there, all I'm going to do is run around the grounds, do loads of push-ups, sit-ups and just get super fit. And I wasn't allowed to do anything.
Mm.
And it was... mentioned cross addiction, which I had no idea at the time, which I know now. Could you tell us what cross addiction is?
Well, it's simply when you have one identifiable issue that's an addictive process, but having put it down, you move on to something else. So chapter and verse, if you go to an AA meeting for alcoholism, you walk through the door and the first thing you're confronted with is a load of caffeine and a load of sugar. Because people, you know, come in emaciated, and within weeks they've ballooned, because sugar takes over from alcohol, and sugar is probably the most mood altering substance on the planet.
Yeah.
Hence, you know, the epidemic of obesity.
Yeah. And is that the most common thing that people go on to? Because I know a lot of people, their smoking goes up, or they become a super ultra marathon runner overnight, or they do something excessive.
Yes.
I've tried to, when I went into the Priory myself, I went in for anxiety and depression and slowly realized in about 5 minutes that I had a problem with alcohol and drugs. And I was like, okay, I'm going to stop what you did, coffee, tea, I'm not going to have anything. And within 4 days, I was completely pulling my hair out.
Yes.
And realized that's obviously too much. On long-term recovery, what's the kind of goal? So for me personally, I've tried to be non-addictive because I used to be addicted to the gym prior to coming to recovery. And I've always been scared of being addicted to something and just getting too much into it.
Yeah.
And I switched to smoking when I came in for probably 7 years of my recovery, and I found it really hard to stop. When that stopped, food came up, and it's been a journey. There's not a perfect recovery, but what is the sort of average journey for someone to come in to keep yourself from being addicted, if that's the right terminology?
So this actually hits on my core belief. And after 10 years in recovery and running the Priory, we were getting lots and lots and lots of relapse. And it happens in most treatment centres. And I couldn't figure it out because, you know, in the treatment centre, people had really good recovery. But then they go out and relapse. And I couldn't figure it out. And then someone suggested to me that there was this lady in Arizona called Pia Melody who had a relapse prevention process. So Hillary went out as a sort of ambassador, came back and said, you've got to see this. You've just got to see this. So I and Adela and Trish all went out to Arizona to do what's called PIT training, P-I-T, post-induction therapy. It's an immaterial term. What it means is looking at where it comes from.
The root cause of the addiction, you mean, yeah.
Yes. And my core belief now, having sort of been in the process for quite a few years, is that all psychological issues emanate from childhood, all of them. If you come into a treatment center and you get well from the addiction that you're presenting with, but you don't deal with the core issue back at 5 years old, then you're setting yourself up for more pain. Because if you take away the substance that's a coping mechanism, that's all it is, a coping mechanism, and you don't do something to assuage the feelings that emanate from childhood, then you're going to be in lots and lots of feelings that are very uncomfortable. Yeah. And then you try something else, and then you stop that, and then you try something else, and you stop that, and you're backwards and forwards. But none of it actually works. I actually believe that 99% of therapy is barking up the wrong tree because they deal with the presenting issue, not the issue.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
100%. It's like having, you've probably heard this before, but it's like having a cold, isn't it? If you take away the runny nose, which is a symptom of cold, you still have a cold. But if you get rid of the cold, you don't have a runny nose.
Yeah. Well, if you have a headache and you take a pill for it, you're not actually dealing with the cause of the headache. You're dealing with the symptom, the headache.
Divorce was the solution.
A pain in my neck. Yeah.
So how does that work for you? Because obviously you wrote in a book about that it blew you away, basically, to do this course with Pia Melody. How did that change or enhance you as a therapist after?
Well, to start off with, when I did it, first of all, I got to be the guinea pig.
Right.
So I got there, and after the first morning, I said to Pia, I don't think I can do this. This is really bringing up stuff for me. And she said, well, let me work with you. I have to demonstrate the techniques. Let me work with you. So I spent 4.5 days in bits. Absolutely falling apart. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. So when I came back, I thought, I can use this with some of my patients. And now, 15 years later, it applies to 99.99% of my patients.
Really?
Yes.
And is that after, if they need detox or after they come in for a specific thing?
So if somebody comes in feeling depressed.
Is this in recovery, David, or general?
Just generally.
Yeah.
Whether somebody's in recovery or not, whether somebody's an addict or not, whether somebody's just got an issue with depression or anxiety, It's all back there.
Yeah.
And it works. I think that the reason people get addicted, the $64,000 bit, is sensitivity. So the more sensitive you are, the more likely it is to affect you adversely, childhood trauma.
Yeah.
And the more likely you are to look for something to take away that pain. So, you know, it's the most loving thing that you can do for yourself.
Not feeling like it at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. But
yeah. I was 5 years sober, living in Los Angeles, and I got to that stage where I have never felt anxiety and fear like it for no apparent reason. Maybe it was me making up, but it was being in a different environment and trying a new business. And it was so bad. I used to have to get acupuncture here on my chest to relieve the stress of it. So I checked into somewhere, Cottonwood in Arizona, to do a trauma course for a week. And I thought it was something else I went in for. And it was a lady called Raquel Lerner.
Oh, yeah, I know Raquel.
And she was terrific. I got on really well with her. And she said, we did a lot of stuff together. And there was a lot of crying, screaming, play roles. She had bats with sponges that you could exhaust yourself hitting and stuff.
Self-beating, to cushion you.
Yeah, and it was actually incredible because I really looked at some core stuff. Do you think there's a time where if someone is an addict and they come into recovery, whether it be via a treatment center or into a 12-step program, can you do trauma therapy too early? And what do you notice the difference between someone who is in recovery but hasn't looked at the trauma to someone who has?
So in terms of timescale, the Meadows, where Peer Melody worked, they do it in a five-week program. So they have a five-week program, a week of which is trauma reduction, post-induction therapy. I have a feeling that's probably too early.
Yeah.
I'll qualify that in a second. A bit further down the line, when somebody is stable, because doing trauma work is destabilizing. So if you're unstable and then you do trauma work, there's more chance of a relapse. So we don't want that. So, you know, I'm guided by common sense and in conjunction with usually a consultant psychiatrist. I've worked with Neil Brenner for 15 years, and I trust him implicitly. And if he says yes, it's okay, then I'll go ahead. And if he says wait a bit, then I'll wait a bit.
Fair enough.
There are some people who need a trauma program to get into recovery.
Okay.
And then there are lots of people who need trauma therapy after they've been in recovery. But if you are very traumatized and you can't get it together, because there's a phenomenon, the trauma stuff acts on a bit in your midbrain called your limbic system, and specifically a little bit called the amygdala. And the amygdala is probably the most powerful bit in your brain, because it does fight, flight or freeze, and it has the ability to switch off your cortex. It can hijack your cortex. Now, it doesn't work the other way. So it can switch off your cortex and your thinking goes awry, but you can't get at your amygdala cognitively. So CBT for this stuff is just a non-starter, because it can't get at the bit that needs to be gotten at. So if you're very, very traumatized and your amygdala keeps acting out, then we need to calm that in order for you to have enough cognition to, you know, to do life. But that's quite unusual, but it is a thing.
I must have a very good amygdala, because I tell you, honestly, for the first 20 years of my life, I think that was running show, literally. I always ask this question because, I've trained in a really wonderful old Chinese martial art called Pakwa.
Mm-hmm.
It follows the book of I Ching. The Book of Life, and it's not a woo-woo practice, actually a very good physical application where you kind of do mind, body and spirit over a long period of time and bring around awareness inside and outside of yourself. And it's really allowed me, plus a 12-step program, to be, to kind of know that that's what's going on. Because my thinking goes, my vision can sometimes go, I'm so hyper-aware that I'm almost like in the CIA. I can track everyone on the street walking down, but I can't be present with my thoughts and what I'm doing. And it takes me a minute to just, I don't say it now. I used to say where I am, what I'm doing, how I feel, what I'm seeing, just to bring me back to a place. And now I can do it by feeling, not all the time, depends on situation, but the majority of the time. So it doesn't just switch, but I can, I've learned to bring myself back into the present and be reasonable.
That's a really good technique because, you know, I think I lived for the first 46 years of my life, even after recovery, in a trauma process, you know, in a constant state of anxiety and trauma because I didn't know any better. And it had started when I was a very small child and just never went away.
I've been really looking at my, I did a little bit more trauma stuff recently and there was something very clear about a trauma response I'd have when something happened and I'd just be like, fine, I'll cut that person out. I won't talk to this person anymore. And it was the inability to deal with the communication rather than just easy to shut someone off. And I never realized that that was a trauma. I thought I was just being strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I only worked on that quite recently. Because I've got no friends anymore, basically. But anxiety and stress, I know you specialize in that as well. I didn't know I was stressed before, anxious, because that was how I was, pretty much what you just said, for years and years and years. And now I know the difference because I've had respites from that and I prefer to be in the respite stage than not. Mm. But if I'm honest, there's a part of me that doesn't want to let the anxiety go completely because it stood me in good stead in certain situations. Does everybody that suffers from addiction in one way, shape or form have anxiety and have stress? And does that go?
Yes, I think sometimes they might not even appreciate they have it, but it's always present. In fact, I would put it down to, as a core process, fear. That fear is the core problem and what we call it, anxiety, stress, whatever, it's actually comes from fear. So I have never, ever, ever been angry without first being afraid.
Yeah.
Now, people say, well, that's not true. But it is if you think about it. If you go back and think about what was the process before you started to get angry, quite often, you know, it's something that frightens you.
It takes work and knowing yourself and awareness to know how to do that little process. But it's very freeing to know that. I remember saying, probably when I was in treatment first time, don't have any fears.
Mm.
Nothing at all bothers me. Underneath, I was absolutely in bits. It was all fear. Everything was fear. What's really interesting is I used to get tremendous anxiety going for auditions, to the point where I'd be pacing up and down. I couldn't have coffee for 2 days because of the anxiety, but it was generally fear. And I used to write the fears down to see what one it actually is that it wasn't being judged, it wasn't not getting the job, but I never really found the actual pinpoint of what it was. So I know it was an imagined thing because nothing had happened. So it's incredible how much anxiety you can get from imagined fear as well as
absolutely
real fear, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you think about it, addiction is mostly about projection. You know, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen here? What am I going to do here? What am I going to do there? And that winds you up into a knot. And the only way to deal with that is to use your drug of choice.
I always wondered how clever addiction is. So was I drinking and drugging to quell this pain and to hide it and shore myself up? B, because it was a legitimate excuse? Or is my addiction clever enough to use that excuse as an excuse to drink and drug? Does that make sense?
Both, because one starts it off and the other takes over.
Yeah.
So, you know, once you've found something that works, you need to rationalize it. So if you say to an addict, you drink too much, no, I don't, because blah, 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 blah. So there's all the justification in the world.
Yeah.
So we're very clever at analyzing what it's all about and thinking of all the excuses known to mankind so that we can carry on the process. So I think that the originator is the fear and the anxiety or the stress or the trauma. But then once we've started doing it and we find that it works, why would we want to stop?
Mm.
You know, why would you voluntarily go to a doctor and say, "Doctor, I'm an alcoholic"? Yeah. You have to be crazy.
Yeah. In your private practice, which you've had for 20 years, is there a difference between people that are food addiction, gambling, or anything else?
No, I don't think so. The severity changes, and the substances change a little bit. I still think the most dangerous drug in the world is sugar. It's the one people use the most.
My wife's she's a doctor. She's a brilliant nutritionist. So I get to see all the insight papers from peer reviews and stuff in Imperial. And it's weird because sugar's obviously, especially in America, it's in everything. You know, you've been there. It's like, even if you have cornflakes there, they're like Frosties. There's just sugar in everything.
Everything, yeah.
And you can see by the consequences of the people.
And in America, they've they've been using for years, something called high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
Which is much sweeter. And actually has the ability to switch off the enzyme in your liver that says I'm full.
Yeah.
So you just keep eating it.
Yeah.
There was a guy, Professor Yudkin, wrote a book 20, 30 years ago called Pure, White and Deadly, I think it was called, and about sugar. And he was vilified. They hounded him out of his job
Also in your book, I love this sentence. You said that you consider addiction a gift.
Yes.
People, what do you mean by that?
Well, if you're walking around on the planet, I think that everybody has a degree of, use the oft-known term codependence, childhood trauma. Everybody has a degree of it because nobody has a fantastic childhood. I don't believe that. If you're, you know, you can get through life, but if you're very sensitive and you end up as an addict, okay, if you can get recovery from that and deal with your child, then you have so much more awareness of what's in the world, and you can like set out your stall to do good works rather than, I don't mean in a Raya Heap way. I mean, you know, just to be nice, to be kind, to be gentle, to be loving. It's so much easier and nicer than that avaricious grabbing, you know, onto especially money.
Yeah, it's true. Actually, it's kind of like priorities change. My priorities have changed. I remember I shared before, I had a lunch in Chateau Marmont in Los Angeles with a photographer I used to work with, and some magazine editor. And I was probably, I think, 4 years sober at the time. My goal was to be a sober person, look after myself, and was not about money. Because one of my goals was just money. Cool. Prior, and I did really well, made a fortune, had more things than I ever had wished for, and was deadly unhappy. And it was at the height of my using, because the pain from trauma,
yes,
and the pain from experience and abuse stuff I had was just too much. And I was on the road to killing myself, basically, and kept buying things to show you that I was okay. I had to show you I was okay because the pain was so much. And I was so happy with my recovery, and I turned lots of work down, and I was living in LA, not really to be in the movies. I was studying the martial art I was telling you about, but I got back into the business again. And he said to me, "Yeah, it's a shame you never made it, isn't it, Paul? It's a shame you didn't really do stuff." And I for a second, he got me. I looked at him, I thought, "You motherfucker."
that's
that hurt.
That's like a knife.
Yeah, and I thought, do you know how difficult it is get into recovery. Do you know how difficult it is to be sober and work on yourself and not go for the money and put that second and put your family first and your friends first and everything else? It was no point in telling him because he's just after the shiny things in life, and that was it. But what it did, it really affected me for a couple of days, because I thought, yeah, you're right. I don't have that house higher up on the hill and I don't have brand new Range Rover, whatever it is. But I sat and I thought, no, kids, you've done good. You've saved your life, you know, through a program and with other people, and you're becoming someone who you want to be, someone who's actually caring. I am soft, very vulnerable as a child, very empathetic. And I like those qualities, because I'd walk in a gym and say, he's not lifting much, or he's a bit tubby, or he's, I would just judge everybody.
Yeah.
Now I walk in a gym and I see someone who's unfit and I think, good on them. Like, good on you. You don't know what they've been through, you know? Yeah. It opens, like you said, things up, perspective up, and it makes the world a nicer place.
I guess I first had that experience. I was days sober, running a pub. And I woke up one morning and the window was open and I could hear birds singing in the trees. And I realized I hadn't heard that for 20 years, 30 years. It was so beautiful to hear just a bird singing, you know. And recovery opens up that part of your life. I think that you narrow down, the fear, but you also narrow down the joy, and getting recovery can open up the fear a little bit, but also it opens up the joy. So you know, one of the most joyful things I've heard in years and years and years was this guy called Young Chan Lim at a piano competition, playing Rachmaninoff's Third Piano Concerto. Amazing. It just made the hair stand up on the back of my neck. And it lifted the roof off the auditorium.
Yeah.
You know, so that joy, you can't buy that.
No, and I wouldn't have been able to hear that before coming to recovery.
Yeah.
Because my brain was too fast. I sat in the grounds of the Priory. I'd just had enough one day in a process group, and I did psychodrama, that's it. And it was the weirdest experience. It was like all of my ego, my energy, my fight, everything was gone. And I felt completely raw. And you know the Japanese, when they speak with their breath, don't they?
Yes.
And I was like that. I just was, had tears coming down my face. And I went for a walk out the back. And I went out the ringed area, the fenced area, and sat by this tree just for a minute. I just needed to sit there. And and I heard the birds tweet, and then I smelt the grass, and I looked up and saw the leaves. And to some people, they won't understand this, but personally, it's an incredible moment. And I looked up, and on the tree was a plaque, and the tree had been there for something like 200 years, planted 200 years. And I just had this moment thinking, my life's been so evolved around situations, fears, and opinions. And I'm sitting by this tree that's been there for 200 years. What has this tree seen, and you know, and it just had this amazing moment, and it really kind of broke out of this tight thought process that I had, and it was really, I was really grateful for that moment actually, and it's nice because I don't train my kids, that's the wrong word, but when we walked to school, early on, I was like, oh wow, look at the bee, look at the flowers, do you like these flowers? And we would point out everything, and now, when I'm walking to school, if I'm in a hurry, my little one says, "Daddy, Daddy, look, snowdrops are coming up, aren't they?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, they are." And it just brings you back to being present. So it's a wonderful thing. With fear, David, in recovery, there's been moments where I feel like I can levitate above the kitchen floor and no one can touch me. And there's sometimes where I am just, you know, terrified of meeting people or going to do something. How do you still have fear? How do you regulate it? Is it something that someone in recovery will gain as an asset at points?
I think that I'll always have a degree of fear, because I think there are some things, especially the younger you are when you experience it. it just sticks in there. In terms of regulating it, one of the things that I do is when I have a client, a patient, who goes through a trauma program, on Monday evenings I run an aftercare group for people, and it's free of charge. And I had 27 people a fortnight ago, and people can come in and talk openly about what's actually going on for them and get feedback from people, but they get feedback by identification. And it's amazing how fear lessens when you know you're not the only one with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, so if I can digress a bit. So I believe that as a species, we've been around on the planet for about 4 million years. And for all of those 4 million years, the only way we've survived against all the odds, when Cro-Magnons and Neanderthals died off, we have survived because we collaborated. We got into tribes. And I think that's in our very DNA, that we need to belong somewhere,
yeah,
with a group of people, specifically with a group of people, not belonging to somebody else, but with a group. And when you're part of a group, you can relax, because, you know, if I put you on the Serengeti plain tonight, you'd be a bag of bones in the morning. But if there's 20 people,
my agent would like that, by the way.
if there's 20 people, they survive. So if you think about it, it's directly correlated to 12-step fellowships, because 12-step fellowships are groups where you can find people like you. So I think that experience of being connected to people and having an understanding that you are like everybody else, especially when you have been traumatized and you're highly sensitive and think that you're the only person in the world who feels this way.
Yeah.
The moment you get the experience of understanding that people, you know, it's very common, it helps a huge amount to not be alone.
I've been in different clubs, from motorbike clubs to car clubs to boxing clubs and all sorts of things. But I've always felt lonely, and for the reasons of what you just described really well. And when I finally accepted that a 12-step program is probably the place for me, even though I had different opinions in the beginning, I've never experienced such camaraderie and love.
Mm. Well, if you think about it, the entry into a 12-step fellowship is a near-death experience.
Yeah.
You know, it's imperative. It is literally life and death. And I'm not, 12-step, I've been in 12-step recovery for 37 years. But I understand it, I think, and I love it. But it's got limitations, but everything's got limitations, you know?
What I like about it, people have different groups. Some people can be highly religious, some people can be agnostic, and in between. Some people think that's the answer for everything. Other opinions aren't. But it's nice because it's still a collective that you can allow another person their own thought process or idea of it, but the fundamentals are the same.
Mm.
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
And I found that as I go on, I've done lots of wacky yoga things, standing on my head for hours trying to find a fast track to spirituality. burning things and stuff. But a 12-step program is really profound for me. It's a real spiritual process.
Mm. Well, people worry that it's a religious program, but, you know, I'm a complete and total atheist. I have no belief in God, but I do believe there's a higher power for me, which is group of drunks.
Yeah.
You know, and the group experience is so, so valuable. There's nothing else like it that I've ever come across. And in my Monday night group, it's not a 12-step process. It's an open group, and I run it to keep order and make sure everybody doesn't get hurt. But it works just as well.
And are these people pretty much new in recovery, or is it long term?
Both. So somebody that did a trauma program last week is entitled to come.
Right.
But on a similar basis, I've got people who've been coming 10 years.
We spoke before briefly. Are you going into something new?
Not new. I'm separating from an association that I've had for 20 years with the Priory. And consequently, I have space for new clients. So I'm rehashing my website, and you know, I'm available. I work on Zoom. I was very anti it when I first started, but I found that it works extremely well. And in fact, it's probably more incisive than a face-to-face.
Is that because the person's focused on you on the screen?
And we're focused on what we're there for. Because you can get distracted by surroundings and things. It focuses the therapy greatly, I think.
What advice would you give if someone is unwell, they're thinking about recovery, they need it, or they're looking after someone who's drinking or in their own trouble? What would you say the sort of first steps would be?
First off, try and take the anger and frustration out of it. Because if you're dealing with somebody that's got an addiction, it can be extremely frustrating for the other person or people. They are doing the best they can with a stacked deck, and they don't know that. So the first thing is to have compassion, to care, to encourage them to seek help. And if it's you that's got the problem, don't be afraid. There's great help. And, you know, my reason for being is to take the fear out of people's lives. It's so, so important, because I don't want anybody to ever go through what I went through. And if I can help that process, then I will. If you know you have a problem, you can simply go to an AA meeting. Just walk through the door. You can go to your GP. You can get a referral to a consultant psychiatrist, or you can look up a therapist. There are plenty of those. If what you find doesn't suit, find somebody else. You know, not every therapist suits everybody. It's very, very apparent very quickly if you click with somebody. You know, if you make a therapeutic alliance with somebody, then it works. You almost don't have to say anything. It works.
Yeah, you know. David, it's been so nice. Too short. Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome.
Thanks.
Nice to be here.
Thank you. Damn, that went quick.
Yeah, didn't it? Jesus. Bloody hell. It seemed like 5 minutes.
This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholefort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up, and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Giulia Ciccolella, Ria Musa, and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefort.